Hello, fellow homebrewers. JP here, and I want to introduce to you the brand new Brewbuilt X1 Conical Series available at More Beer. More Beer sells the highest standard in homebrewing equipment, and the Brewbuilt Conicals are just that. They're made from mirror-polished 304 stainless steel, and they come with loads of features that you and I have been looking for. They have a full 2-inch bottom dump valve, which will eliminate your clogging issues, while the sturdy base includes 4 reinforced legs, just like those big pro tanks do. More Beer also carries the Brewbuilt line of options and add-ons like casters, pressure kits, and even external glycol chillers. So you can find out more about the new Brewbuilt X1 conical uni tanks by going over to morebeer.com for detailed videos on the entire line of Brewbuilt conicals. You can trust Brewbuilt with your next fermentation, and you can trust More Beer to find the right conical for you. Brewbuilt at morebeer.com.
The Vietnam War, it's over.
Your job's just begun.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of spycraft. Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
Hello and welcome to the session. We are back in the studio once again, trying some new things for the first time since the pandemic, where, you know, during the pandemic, we had nobody in the studio ever except for me, which Zoom made very simple. And then now I switched back to nobody on Zoom ever because I wanted humans back in the studio. And then my friend Jamil, who's with us today, calls me up, sends me an email and says, I want to do a Zoom interview where a bunch of us come in the studio and then somebody's not in the studio. And then why don't you go ahead and figure that out? And that's where Zoom becomes difficult. But I think I have us working today and ready for a fantastic show with Jamil's friend and hopefully soon to become the rest of our friend here on the Brewing Network, George Toumet. And he's from Dimorschlüdel. George, am I close?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I don't really speak Dutch, but that's as far as I will go, too. So it's the Dimorschlüdel. Out from the Netherlands.
Morschlotel from the Netherlands. And yes. And so that kind of dives right into why we're here today. Because Jamil and Jason went on what I'm going to call from now on Jamil and Jason's magic voyage.
Funny, that's what we called it.
Is that what you... weird. You did too, yeah. I think Jason's maybe never been on such a voyage before.
Not a magic one. No,
I haven't got to all those places. So I've been through Germany and Czech Republic and England and whatnot. But we went up to the Netherlands and then northern part of Germany, which I had never been to before. So
okay.
Yeah.
Got it. And Jamil, who's spoiled rotten, has done this trip like 100 times at this point, I think. He's gone everywhere.
Yes.
And knows every brewer in the world, I think, now.
Pretty much.
And so you guys go on this trip, as Jason mentioned, you end up in Germany, and we could talk about a few other places, but either the very first or one of the first places you end up is in the Netherlands?
Yeah, we flew into Amsterdam and got there and... first day was just settling in, and then the second day, a friend of mine, Aaron, he's a pilot for KLM. He's a home brewer. I've known him for a number of years and visited him a few times. He was like, I want to take you to my favorite brewery in the world.
Okay.
And so he set up a time for us to come visit, and he rented a car, drove us an hour out to, he took the day off of work.
Wow.
drove us out there, and yeah, we had an awesome time.
Nice. So you end up at Morschlüdel for the first time, and you don't spend any time, just out of curiosity. You don't even spend the night getting high in Amsterdam or anything?
No. We actually looked for some sort of edibles.
Yeah.
But, you know, they don't do edibles right there. They, it's, they're restricted to like just baked goods, like brownies and cakes.
Okay.
And they're not allowed to do like any gummies or anything like that. And then they're not allowed to tell you how much THC is in anything.
Why? That's odd.
Yeah, and that seems strange.
It would seem to be the opposite is right. than what it should be.
Right, right. So yeah. You don't really know what you're getting.
Okay.
And then a lot of it seems kind of like floor sweepings after they've, you know, okay. rolled a bunch of joints. And then
you just went to the tourist spot.
And then they just, no, we actually hunted down the like what's supposed to be the best
place. He was trying
place.
Real hard. Okay. He really, really wanted to get the good stuff.
Yeah, right. Yeah. That just didn't happen. Had to go old school. Okay. All alcohol.
Okay.
All alcohol.
Well,
trip.
Interestingly enough, and we'll get into this as we dive into the beers, I mean, at everything I've read on the cans that you sent us, George, are between, well, I guess I'll give you a little bit of range, from 3.5% all the way up to like 16%. So who needs to get high when you're drinking 16% beer?
Right. Yeah, one can will do you.
Okay, so to help get us started with the experience, why don't we talk about the beer that's in our glass?
Yeah.
So, George, we decided to open Crank the Session Juice, which is listed as an IPA, but also listed as an IPA at 3.5%. Now, the narcissist in me wants to think that this beer is named after my show, which is called The Session. And tell me I'm right.
Yeah, you are right.
Okay, perfect. No, because you have some other beers in front of me that are like different variations of Crank the Session and Crank. So you wanted to start with the name for us and then you can talk about the beer?
Yeah, I mean, that's our core range IPA. It's Crank the Juice. And we have this thing of doing iterations of core range beers. And this one was brewed specifically for the Swedish market where they have alcohol laws where to be sold on regular supermarkets, it needs to be 3.5% or below alcohol. So we had to tweak our main recipe to make it sessionable to be within the 3.5%. So there goes the name, the Crank the Session.
Okay.
Juice. And it's just the same recipe, so the same hops, same malt, just little tweaks to make it to go a little below the usual 5.5 up to 3.5% ABV.
Got it.
I think this is one of the best 3.5% IPAs I've ever had.
It's fantastic.
It's a lot of flavor.
It's wonderful.
But without having a bunch...
It's a body too, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's not thin and bitter, which is what you can often end up with. Especially if you, like you said, if you started with your regular version at like 5.5 and that you're just accepting the challenge to get it down to this, I feel like often is where you end up with kind of a thin and
this is balanced.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is totally balanced.
That really means a lot because I think it's actually even the same malt bill as a 5.5. It was just the mash temperature adjusted to ferment a little less than normal. And then it ended up a bit higher, like on the low force, so we had to dilute the beer a little bit, and that made the beer a bit thin. So we then did some mineral corrections post pre-packaging on the bright, just to make sure it was right with the right mouthfeel, right bitterness, and I think it turned out pretty nice. It was a pretty well-tweaked beer to get the 3.5% rolling out in a pretty balanced way.
Yeah. I think the Swedes are onto something because I could drink a few pints of this.
That's what I'd be drinking tonight if I had it on tap. I'd be like, give me a couple of pints of that.
It's the only beer that I actually usually carry at my place. I mean, we brew a lot of high alcohol stuff. We'll get into that later, but we don't brew a lot of lower ABV beers. So I like to keep this one around because, you know, it's 3.5, it's sessionable. We can have a few pints and just enjoy life.
Is it hard to sell, though, outside of the Swedish market?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, low ABV beers usually have this bad reputation.
Yeah, here
too.
They're
thin, they're watery. And but I think when people try it, especially in bars, once you have the first glass, you'll see the full potential of it and just keep going back.
Yeah, we don't even not only get the thin and watery comments and beers, but at my bar, we also get the like, well, if I'm going to spend $7 on a pint, you know, I kind of want it to have some alcohol in it.
Right.
Whereas I'm like, if I'm going to spend $7 on a pint, I want to make sure it tastes good first. Like, I kind of don't care about the ABV.
Right.
Unless I'm like being careful that it's got too much, to be honest with you.
Mm-hmm.
Not too low.
Yeah, but yeah, you know, a lot of people, they see you 3.5% selling for the same price as a 7% because the hops are all the same. The malt's all the same.
Right.
And, you know, it costs the production would cost the same. But they're just like, well, it should be half the price. It's like, well, no, it's yeah, all no. the same ingredients, all the same labor.
Yeah.
You know, costs.
Yeah, especially with an IPA like this. I mean, you're going to add tons of hops and dry hopping in this. That's where your expense is.
Yeah.
What are the hops, George?
Citra and Mosaic. We just went straight. I mean, we talked about that when we were there. It's the combination that doesn't fail. Always guaranteed success.
That's true.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I know brewers who refuse to make almost any beer without Mosaic in it at all, ever. With that one. Yeah, that's really nice. Excellent. Okay, so you guys end up at the brewery. You've never met them before, but your friend brings you there because it's one of his favorites. So kind of walk me through that. Is it out in the middle of nowhere? Where do you end up?
It's kind of like in an industrial place where it was like, we had a little trouble finding it at first.
And the door. We couldn't find the door.
Right, right. Yeah. No, it was behind like a gas station, you know, like all the best breweries are.
Yeah.
So we went back behind there, and then he was having trouble finding the door. And I'm like, let's just walk in through the big open roll-up where the forklift is. He's like, no, we don't want to do that. You know, we want to be polite. I'm like, I just walk into all breweries that way.
Right.
So he called them, and they're like, yeah, just walk in through the big roll-up.
There you go.
And he did put his pants back on first before he went in.
That's also fair. Yeah. I mean, it is another country and everything.
But so they were very welcoming, and place was, you know, every building, and they're looking at moving to another building, but every building has its, you know, quirks as to how you fit everything in. So they did some you can tell there's a lot of engineering minds around there because they fit everything in. Everything was done just beautifully. I thought they did a really good job.
Is it just a production brewery or a tasting room too? What's the lay of the land, George?
It's just a production facility. Okay. I guess the laws here are not very easy to get tasting rooms.
Okay.
On production facilities, especially because it's on the industrial area. So right now we can only have a production facility. Eventually, in the future, as we're looking to move into our own building, where this is just a leased space, we're looking towards a new facility, and then we'll try to get our tasting room there too.
Do you have offsite tasting rooms, or are you just production and it goes into offsite accounts?
No, we have a tasting room downtown where we're based in Altmar.
Okay. That's interesting. So you can have a tasting room, you just can't have it at your brewery, your production facility.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
weird. I guess every place has some weird laws though.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So you go, and then what do you find out that is kind of their specialty, Jamil, or do they have one?
Yeah, it's you know, from my view, it's mainly, you know, these, you know, huge stouts that are some barrel aged, some non-barrel aged with lots of interesting flavors and ingredients. Mm-hmm. You know, pretty much when you say, Jason, that was...
Yeah, absolutely.
And
he had us try so many beers, and they were all fantastic.
Yeah.
But man, after sampling...
Right.
I'm glad we had someone to drive us out of there.
Well,
we got a little hammered.
We're going through the box of beers that you sent here, George, or sent with them, I should mention, because they came in lugging this massive box that I then find out that you're their first stop. So they apparently lugged this box all around Europe together.
The fact that we didn't drink the whole thing before we got back, but I'm like, look, we'll save it and we'll do a show.
Yeah.
You know?
Love it.
Well, part of it, we were so beat up when we got back, too. Both of us were like, yeah, we're not drinking for a little while.
Okay.
I'll just put this in the fridge.
There you go. Yeah. Well, and so
we don't get a lot of visitors, so whenever they come by, I just give them beer just to make them happy. So that's the least we can do.
You made us very happy.
You took care of us, for sure.
Your hospitality was wonderful.
Well, and we're going to get through some of these here shortly, but I just as an example, because you're describing these kind of interesting beers that you make, I'm holding a Brunch Blanche in front of me, which is an oat milk breakfast white stout that we're going to try. We've got a freeze-distilled red velvet stout that we're going to try. We've got a rye wine we're going to try. So you guys do really like to make interesting non-traditional beers, it seems.
Yeah, so it all started with four brothers. They, their dad, he had a small brewing kit, and they found it was funny. They started making beers. And at the point, they were having a lot of imperial stouts, mostly American breweries. And they thought that was funny, so they kept on brewing those beers, and they made a name on making big beers. So that's, I guess, where we stand right now, just making big beers. Okay. But then from stouts, we tried to make some variations on doing adjuncts, other flavors, spices, then rye wines and barley wines as well, just to keep things interesting. But that's where we focus, just very out there and extreme beers in general.
Is that, does that have anything to do with the market that you're in, or are you guys very unique in your market too?
Well, there's a demand for very expressive beers around here. That's what I feel. At least the Netherlands seems to be a country where people really seek the great stuff, you know, like great beers, high alcohol, barrel-aged beers.
Yeah.
And there's a huge demand for that kind of stuff.
Okay. Are there a lot of craft breweries in the country?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's insane. I'd say about 900 breweries in the country with 14 million people. So it's quite a lot.
That is quite a lot. Yeah. And how long have you been there? Where are you from, George?
I'm from Portugal.
Okay.
I've been here for 2 years. I just joined the team when they were scaling up production. So I was like the second employee on the team. Wow. And now we're over 25 people.
Wow.
So they just made the commitment that they were growing. So that was a lot of investment was going out at the time on equipment, facility, and all that. So they needed people. And I joined the team as just a brewer back then, now as the head brewer.
Yeah.
And just came to take the role on helping them to scale up.
Were you brewing professionally in Portugal before that?
No, I was working at the brewery, but I was just operations management there. I started at the taproom, then worked my way up to operations management, just kind of tying up the knot between the sales and logistics and production, just making sure the daily operation was going smooth.
Okay.
But I wanted to gig on brewing, so I just moved in for a nice challenge.
Was it just, did you just find an ad that they were looking for a brewer, or how'd you get connected?
Yeah, they were actually seeking two people, so I moved with a former colleague also from Portugal, and they were asking for two brewers, and we applied together. That's kind of a fun story. I mean, we did an interview together for the job. That was pretty funny.
That is funny.
We moved together, and that was that made things easier than just moving along.
Brewing duo. That's
it's like stepbrothers.
yeah, like, sorry, we're just kind of a package deal here. We're both moving.
Yeah. That's how we framed the thing. Like, we sent the application. I was like, hey, you either get both or you get none. So let's talk and see if that works out.
That's great. I love I still would have interviewed you separately. I don't know why. It just seems like the right thing to do. I think that's hilarious that they interviewed you together. Did you answer each other's questions, or did you
just... it was like two interviews separated, but we were just sitting next to each other.
Mm-hmm.
It was funny. I mean, it's important to know that it's a pretty young company. So the four brothers, the oldest is like 32 years old. So it's a pretty young company.
Okay.
Young as the people, not only the company, but the people behind the company, they're pretty young. So I think that laid back posture also helps to get these nice opportunities of communication and engagement.
Sure. And how different is the Netherlands as a lifestyle or culture to Portugal for you?
Yeah, it's completely different. I mean, Portugal has no beer culture. So,
all right.
I mean, in 2009, there were 7 breweries registered in the country. Now there's over 100. So,
okay.
It's not even 10 years of growing things there. So there's no tradition. It's a wine country. So it takes time for people to get used to it. And Netherlands, it's a much more established market with a bigger culture, years of drinking culture. So it's a night and day in terms of sales volume, demand for the market and all that. So it was just a scale up in terms of the demand.
Okay.
All right. Well, why don't we do this? Let's take a quick break so that we can get some different and more beer into our glass. We're going to take a quick break. I want to thank our sponsor today real quick. More Beer. They sponsor this show and every session that we do. Check out Free Beer Fridays on their YouTube channel. Just check out More Beer over on YouTube. And Chris Graham gives stuff away every single Friday over there. So go check them out. And thank them for being a sponsor of our show. You're listening to The Session. I'm your host, Justin Crosley, and we will be right back.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Welcome back to The Session. Thanks for hanging out with us. We are still hanging out with Mohr Schleudel. I'm going to probably say it different every time I do it, but they're from the Netherlands, and George is joining us today to share some of the wonderful beer that he sent home with Jamil and Jason. You guys lugged all over Europe.
We took that case of beer through Amsterdam.
No, I took it at first.
At first, and then it ended up in my suitcase.
Well, right, because then... Like
the whole trip.
Because then I started picking up other stuff.
Oh, is that what it was? Yeah, you carry this heavy beer. Right. Well, I bought some t-shirts.
Yeah. Well, you know, you see...
Said, that's what happened.
You said, "Oh, I got room for it." When we first got it,
I didn't think you were going to bite.
Come on, Mike.
At that point, he was still thankful that he was on this trip
that's
with
right.
you.
Right.
Four days later, and I've been on those trips with you, Jamil. Four days later, it's like, "Fuck this guy. You carry it.
Carry my suitcase while you're at it, will you?"
Yeah. Where else did you? What can I get a brief country list that you guys joined?
Well, we went from there to Dusseldorf,
nice,
and then we did a little side trip to Cologne, and then Bamberg and Munich,
okay,
and then back.
Nice. That's a nice trip. Did you fly all around or
no? Train.
Okay.
Dusseldorf was actually pretty spectacular. We staggered into at Schumacher. We just got there, hadn't eaten all day, we're starving. I'm like, well, Schumacher is really close to the hotel. Let's just walk there, get something to eat. We get there, giant crowd all out in the street, filling the sidewalk. I'm like, damn, wow, it's so busy, we're not going to get in. The guy at the door, he's like, well, did you want to eat? I'm like, yeah. He's like, all right, come on in. It turns out it was their Lotzenbier day.
They only do it twice a year.
Like three days a year. They do it in March. It's a Thursday in March, a Thursday in June, and a Thursday in September.
Okay.
We were there on that Thursday in September just by dumb luck.
Yeah.
And got their special beer that they make. And it was delicious. And the food, it was one of the greatest meals I've ever had in my life.
Oh.
It was tremendous. It was pork knuckle,
and it was done
spectacularly.
Slow roasted, then deep fried.
Yep, that's the way it's supposed to be.
Incredible. And we had other pork knuckles on the trip, but that one was by far the best.
We had so many
pork knuckles that Jason said he had to go to the bathroom.
And
I came up with the phrase, oh, time to knuckle down.
Oh, no.
So we started using the phrase, it's time to knuckle down.
Yeah.
I need to knuckle down.
It does tend to move through you a little bit.
Probably my favorite German dish, though. That's awesome.
Oh, and at this place, it was absolutely the best.
And what was this style of beer?
It was like a bigger version.
Right. 5.5% instead of 4.6.
Okay.
A hoppier, more bitter.
Really flavorful.
Yeah.
Really good.
Tremendous.
And we should have bought some bottles, but we didn't. We talked about it.
Let's buy some bottles.
Or that would have been in my suitcase, too.
He's like,
I've been lugging those as well.
He's like, we'll pass by again, and we'll pick them up then. I don't want to lug them around. I'm like, well, yeah, they may not be here.
Mm.
So we didn't get any.
Okay.
Well, but hey, we got to drink that.
Yeah, I'm happy
beer.
For you.
Pretty awesome.
So the rest of you guys, maybe not so much.
Okay. All right. Before we talk more about the brewery itself, the beer that is now in our glass is Brunch Blanche, which is described as an oatmeal breakfast white stout. It's a 9% beer, color-wise, and if I ever end up putting this video up on YouTube, it's a yellow stout. Talk to us about this beer, George.
Yeah, so that was a bit of a pet peeve to me. Making a white stout for a long time was one of the styles that I said I would never brew. But I usually take these collab beers. It's a collaboration with a Portuguese brewery. They were in town, Letra. They were in town, and I usually get these collab beers to be a bit out there, just to be out of our ordinary role of IPAs and stouts and barley wine. So I try to do something different with these beers. And we have been discussing in a funny way to make a white stout for a few months then. And I'm like, yeah, let's do it, see how it comes out of there. The name of the style, it's a bit out there. The breakfast, oat milk, white stout comes with that. And it was just an idea to get a cold and colored white stout, like a properly cold and colored white stout, where the roast flavor comes from chocolate and coffee edition. A bit of vanilla too. So trying to mimic the stout, where something you'd picture as a stout if you were drinking from a paper cup, something like that. I think it turned out quite interesting. It's something special.
Yeah.
On its own. Probably not the most sessionable beer we've ever brewed, but I like the challenge in that sense.
And I love the idea of, well, you're not really tricking people, but I never like the statement from either new beer drinkers or people who think they don't like beer when they just say, oh, I don't like dark beers.
Right. They're too heavy. And too much alcohol.
And I'm like, okay, cool. Yeah. Then you know what? I'm going to give you something that's not a stout at all. Put it in front of them. And just by color, they'll go, oh, wonderful. And then they'll taste it. They'll go, wonderful. And then I'll basically say, there's nothing about that that isn't a dark beer, except the color. All of the other things. Which actually is a question I have for both you, Jamil, and George. Does anything go missing from a stout when it becomes a white stout? In other words, do you really need it, those dark roasts, to do something different? Is there just some little thing missing?
Well, you know, the amount of roast character you can get becomes limited.
Okay.
If you really want, you know, some intense roastiness, I think that becomes very difficult to achieve.
Okay. But there's plenty of dark beers where even the dark malt, you're not quite going for roast either.
True.
Right? Okay.
Like a Carafa Special or something like that, where it's a huskless midnight wheat or whatever. You know, all those don't contribute very much roastiness, but contribute color.
Okay. What do you think, Georgia? Did you know, describe the challenge to you, too?
Yeah, I think if I were to brew this beer again, I would have included a little bit of peated malt just to mimic the roastiness aspect, which I think it misses from that beer, but to keep the color light. But I think it's a style of its own. People tend to call it white stout, but
yeah,
I would just scrape the stout out of there. It's just a golden ale with the coffee and chocolate, and it works pretty well. It creates a flavor of its own. The stout, I think it's more of a gimmick to play around. But yeah, stout is a thing. A white stout is a different style completely.
Okay.
That's an interesting thought, the peated malt, because one, I hate peated malt, but two, you know, I've always said, you know, the thing about peated malt is it's, you know, phenolic. And, you know, it's got those phenols. But so do dark roasted grains. There are phenols that are part of the roast.
Okay.
And, yeah, I wonder if you used a really tiny amount of peated malt, if that would kind of give the impression. I think that's a really fascinating idea. Have you tried that before, George?
Yeah, I made one back in Portugal while I'm brewing, doing a bit of peated malt. I at some point meant to include that in this beer, Chris. I don't know why I did it, but it never ended up being there.
That's fascinating. I don't think I've ever tried that. Now, George is also working on a book where he reveals a lot of his secrets of
really?
Flavors and adjuncts and things like that, so... I don't know when that's coming out, but someday in the future.
Hopefully this year. Let's see if that works out.
Is that like
now you're on the hook to get it done?
Yeah. Now we've put it out there for you. So, who's the market for that? Is that pro brewers, home brewers? Do you care? Just curious.
I'd say mostly home brewers and some pro brewers. There's a bit of a kind of a wide knowledge there, or like secrets or tips, ideas. Like broadening a bit of your school of thought, just to be more broad in the way you think beer.
Okay.
Like these things of incorporating peated malt in a white stout, that kind of thoughts about beer.
Okay, got it. Yeah, so to me, this, you know, if you did blind tasting of this beer and some dark stouts in front of mm-hmm. me, I wouldn't be able to go, oh yeah, that's the white one, that's the dark one. Blind, you know mm-hmm. what I mean? Mm-hmm. Same with, like, there's another brewery out here who makes one, Faction, and theirs is called Anomaly. And he made it as a joke to start and promised he'd never make it again. And then it became like their second most popular beer ever. And so his wife makes him brew it in constant rotation now. And he, I think he still hates that he has to brew it. But it was so good. And so I feel perfectly done. Like if you did it blind, no one's ever going to tell you it's a white stout.
Roger's a great brewer.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Just won a couple medals at GABF this year, as a matter of fact, too. All right. Well, so tell me a little bit more about the brewery experience. I anything unique that you found there, Jamil? I know you guys manufacture your own equipment in some ways too, but
right. I, you know, for me, that's a difficult question because what I kind of keyed in on was the fact that a lot of places there was, and I think George said something about if they need something welded or something built, they just tell them they need something built, and they come in, and a welder shows up with a bunch of stainless and starts
right then and
stuff
there
together. Yeah, so it, you could tell that that was the case. They had access to that kind of personnel and technology. So
instead of having to wait months and order things,
right, or just order something stock, or mm-hmm. building things out of wood instead of stainless. I think that's what really was the thing that I keyed on. How about you, Jason?
Yeah, I mean, really well put together. You could tell that they designed this place and they added to it, almost Winchester Mystery House kind of style, where they mm-hmm. really put this, added this, added that, but it all made sense. Mm-hmm. And based off of probably what George said he needed.
Right.
And they're using all this equipment really, really well, and he's super knowledgeable. And so, yeah, you could tell in the product. It's fantastic.
So let's get to the bottom of that, George. Your founders are also engineers to start?
Yeah, I mean, the whole family, I mean, the four brothers, they're all engineers. Their dad's an engineer working with welding, there you go, for over 40 years now. So, yeah, it's an engineering-based company. And actually, they branched out from the brewing side to actually have their own engineering company building some packaging solutions for small size brewers like we are. And that's pretty nice because we can prototype equipment internally and then just sell that to other breweries that have the same needs we have. It comes really handy to have that knowledge in-house and solving some of those problems where you need a part welded, you need to figure out a solution for a problem, and they just step in and things just work super fast in that regard.
Yeah, brewery / engineering shop, that's kind of a dream come true for most brewers, especially for you, George. It might be a pain in the ass for them, but George is like, yep, need this, and I want it tomorrow, please.
That'd be nice.
That's pretty much how it works.
Yeah. That would be so nice.
Right.
Yeah. I have to call the guys over at Heretic that I know. I'm like, hey, you come over and help me? If Jesse can't fix it,
right,
maybe I can get somebody to come over and weld something for me.
When the beer turns out this great, I don't think they mind. Whatever George wants, George gets.
I love that. All right. We just poured ourselves Willy Tonka, George. Described here has Tonka, coconut, and white chocolate imperial stout. And you want to guess the ABV? You just took a sip, Jay-Z. I know that's a tough game to play, but why not?
It's tucked in there well, I know that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh, great coconut in the nose.
Go maybe 12, 13?
Nailed it. 12% alcohol right there. Yeah. Tell us about this beer, George.
Yeah, so that's part of the series we brew, Willy Tonka. So it's just an imperial stout, always with the tonka beans added to it. And then we go through iterations. That one, coconut and white chocolate added to it. Here comes the engineering part. So we have this addition tank we used to do the adjuncts. And we have a tiny one that could take, I don't know, like 50, 60 kilos of coconut flakes in. We needed one bigger. So we just got a yeast tank, welded some parts into that, got a strainer here and there, and now it can take four times as more coconut flakes inside. So that was actually the first time we did coconut in there And it was so full that the top of the coconut didn't even get soaked in beer because it was just, yeah, just completely packed with the adjuncts.
So what is a tonka bean?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's weird. I guess it's kind of not legal in the U.S., so you don't see that a lot, at least commercially in the U.S., I guess. It's a kind of a vanilla bean mixed with a cinnamon stick, in a way.
Interesting.
If I had to translate that into things, other things.
That's another delicious beer.
Yeah.
It's super flavorful. It's quite creamy in a way, not as sweet as vanilla, and not as spicy as cinnamon, as a really a flavor profile of its own, but it pairs super well with the stouts.
So this falls into the pastry stout category, right? Kind of, you know, that sort of general term that we use out here?
Yeah, sure.
In the neighborhood. You got some residual sweetness in there, and it's,
yeah.
Is there lactose in this?
No, there's no lactose or maltodextrin or any other unfermentable sugar. That's just malt. So some beers we do use either lactose or maltodextrin, but not that often. It depends on the type of beer we're brewing. But that one's just a malt all throughout, just the way we brew it to keep a bit on the sweet side. And I guess the adjunct with chocolate and tonka and the coconut just brings some of the creaminess out that gets you perceived sweetness.
I see. Well, I only bring that up because I'm trying to figure out a category so that I can make the statement, it is one of the best I've ever had in this category. Yeah. But I needed to find a category to say it because it's, like, I could just say Imperial Stout. It's actually also one of the best Imperial Stouts I've ever had. Just
What's the highest mash temperature you use? You mentioned high mash temp on the session IPA.
That one, I'd say, like, 73°C. So I can get a calculator.
Yes, quick. Let's all do Fahrenheit math.
163.4.
Yeah, Jamil does it.
Yeah.
Wow. That's his phone. He's don't believe anything.
Don't ruin the mystique.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, don't. I let you look behind the curtain here for a second.
Yeah. And is that the highest mash temp you've used?
Yeah, that's for us. Wow. The session IPA. That's for stouts, a little bit lower, but I guess just saturating a lot with malt and mashing in super thick at a pretty low ratio of water to grain, that gets the perceived sweetness, and a bit of short mash rest as well helps to keep beta glucans and proteins in there to keep the mouthfeel as full as the beer gets.
Yeah, back when I first started homebrewing, somebody told me that Lagunitas used 74°C on their IPA, which I was like, no, that can't be.
Yeah.
Somebody's lying to me, but I don't know. And then I've done beers at mash temperatures that high, and it works. What was the starting and finishing gravity on this beer? Do you know off the top of your head?
That one should be about 32 Plato's, which times 4, whatever that gets you.
Right.
And finishing gravity should be around 13 Plato's.
13.
Yeah. Memory serves me right, yeah.
Right.
Some of the actual pastry styles where we use unfermentable sugar, they go a bit higher, maybe 17, something like that.
Yeah, it doesn't taste as sweet as a 13 Plato beer.
No, it's not cloying at all.
Yeah, I think some of the other additions, maybe the tonka bean and other stuff and the roast has helped giving it that balance, that dryness.
Well, that's one of the things that I noticed when we were there, and now again, his use of adjuncts in relation to his recipe is. He stands out. I mean, this is unique, unusual.
Right, right.
Really good.
Well, they're all really well balanced. I think that's the thing. Anybody can throw in a bunch of crap
Beer. And often they do.
Right.
And then, it ends up not balanced.
Didn't you have you had a beer called that, right? Throwing a bunch of crap?
Yes.
No, you're right. It has just an awesome balance. I'm curious, do you know why the tonka bean would be illegal in the U.S.? What drug is it used in? Tell me what else tonka beans are used for, George.
I think there's kind of a cumeric acid in it, and that goes beyond the threshold that's legally to be consumed, something like that.
Oh, I see.
That's why you cannot use it. So you could actually, it can be harmful if you have...
So this beer will kill us. Is
too much of it.
You shortened my life.
Oh, wait, this is why he had me carry the suitcase, right?
In case you get
I was smuggling beer in.
Right.
I had no idea.
Yeah.
You're smuggling the Tonka.
You guys are safe. I've had enough of those, and it's fine.
And you're fine.
It's all right.
I thought we were about to find out what George really feels about you. He's like, by the way, in about 30 minutes.
Without the antidote, you're doomed.
Right.
Yeah. By the end of the show.
That's
right.
Exactly.
There's another beer we have to drink to counteract this, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Figure out which one it is.
Yeah. This is just a
delicious
beer. And white chocolate. In what form are you getting chocolate in the beer? How do you add that?
Yeah, we use the cocoa butter in there. And I guess paired with a coconut just mimics a bit of the white chocolate aspect of it.
I see.
Oh, yeah. And we also use the cocoa nibs on their own, so as a bit of both. But the best term we found to describe it was white chocolate.
Right.
Because of the creaminess of the coconut and the beer would just make sense to call it white chocolate.
Sure.
I do enjoy coconut in beer. I don't know why.
Yeah. In the early days of craft brewers, or at least my tasting them, they weren't as good at them. So the first time I had one, it was probably like Maui Brewing or something, and I had to go, all right, what did you do? Because every other coconut beer I've had was shit compared to yours. And he was roasting his own coconut was his main answer.
Gotta
roast your own. Even with his big brewery now, he bought a bunch of ovens to keep roasting coconut. But I think brewers in general have just gotten so much better at it now that most coconut beers, I think, taste great.
They have to roast it.
But this is just a nice combination. And I do pick up the cinnamon, too, from the Tonka. I don't know that I would have pointed it out to you until you said it, George. But then, there's just that little bit. I think that's adding kind of a spiciness to it.
Yeah, a little spicy kind of bite.
A little heat.
Yeah.
Tiny bit, you know.
Yeah, not really cinnamon, but something very akin to cinnamon.
Yeah. Yeah, I like that. All right. Well, we've got more beer to get through, so I'm going to have us take a quick break so we can handle that and get some more of these wonderful beers. I think I don't know if the ABV keeps going up, but we're staying right around this plane from here on out, boys. So, sip slowly. We've got a little more show left to do. Hang in there. You're listening to The Session, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to The Session. Thank you so much for hanging out with us. We are still here with George from Moor Schlüdel out of the Netherlands, and we're trying all sorts of good beer from him. Very good beer. Let me just rephrase that, George, because it's just tasting awesome. I just shared some with my customers out there, and as I left them alone for a minute, and as I was walking back by, I hear them murmuring how fantastic it is, too. So a little bonus for if you come hang out at the Hop Grenade when we do shows like this, you get beers you'd never get to try before.
I wouldn't bring you crap.
Nope, you don't.
You brought me in here, though.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
So it was that one time.
Once in 15 years, not so bad.
So you're not batting 1,000.
Let me ask you this before we dive into the next beer. I am noticing on many of your labels actual photographs of people on them. Not just drawings, not cartoons, but photographs of people. What's that about?
Yeah, so that would make more sense if you had the whole set, but we do this pack every year for the anniversary, beer pack. And since it's our 6th anniversary, we were trying to think of teams that would pair with 6. And I sold them the idea that 4 brothers, mom and dad, since they all work at the brewery, that would be the ideal.
Yeah.
So we just made the beer for each one of the family members. And at first it was just a caricature or something like that of each one of the family members, but we ended up just going straight with the photos.
Yeah.
So each of the family members got their own photograph-based label and a beer to represent whatever they wanted to drink or like. So they have all a little story behind that why it was brewed like that.
Nice. So now if it was my photo, I would hate your idea, but as a consumer, I think it's awesome to go with the real photo.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, years ago it might have just looked like bad art, a little cheesy or something, but it, nowadays it totally fits. It's a little retro, and I love that I'm actually just looking at the face of somebody from the family on the can. I think it's cool. The one we have in our glass now, and I guess it's called, you said, the 6 years series, which is for the sixth anniversary. The rye wine in our glass has Tom on there. So Tom's one of the brothers, I assume?
Yeah, he's one of the brothers at the engineering side. So they divide, two brothers take care of the brewing side, two brothers take care of the engineering side.
Okay, nice. Okay, and so this is a 10% beer. And maybe, can we start simple? Can you just explain to me what a rye wine even is?
Well, it's a barley wine with tons of rye instead of barley into the mix.
Okay.
To get more of the spicy character of rye there.
I see. And does the wine part have to do with ABV, JC, from a style perspective?
Generally, yeah.
Same with barley wine, rye wine. Okay, right. Got it.
But now they're lower ABV than some of the other beers we're making, you know.
Right. Yeah, well, even this one at 10%, right? Is that what I said it was?
That would be a barley wine, rye wine type of thing. Where
right in there.
But, you know, before I left Heretic, we brewed a 18.5% IPA.
Okay. Yeah. Right. And a single IPA at 18.5%?
Yeah.
Okay. Of course you did.
Easy drinker.
I feel like that was just your middle finger of you, as you were leaving.
That's what he did to us. He brought it over in the growler and he's like, hey, you guys want to try this? And we're like, cool.
It's an IPA.
And next thing I know, I'm like, what the hell?
Right. Well, tell me more about the beer. What is the malt bill?
It's just a bunch of rye. We have used some UK specialty rye malts from Simpsons malts. And it was a little funny story because Tom usually carries around a bottle of rye whiskey every now and then. And that led to a conversation about rye whiskey, rye wine. And we were using a lot of rye in our stouts. And there was the challenge of making the rye wine. So we got this red rye gristle. It's basically a special bean from an English maltster.
Okay.
And we tried to make a rye wine. Boiled it for about 6 hours in total. I think it turned out pretty nice.
Wow.
Yeah, did you have trouble mashing? What percentage of rye did you end up using? It's quite got a nice viscous, you know.
Yeah. I think it was about 30% rye in total. But having the mash filter, the Moira mash filter, that really helps a lot with using these pot grains. So it just filters kind of easy in the automation way for you. So, yeah. It's difficult, but not as much as if it was a Walterton.
Right. With the mash filter, you just squeeze the daylights out of it. And
would that be the mash filter that you just had Tom build for you for this beer? Or would that come with your brew system?
No, that came with a...
Okay.
That came made elsewhere.
Okay, yeah. Got it.
But the programming was done in Walt, which is funny as well. So
there we go. It's got a very kind of a deep red color to it.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Definitely some sweetness and a little residual, like on the lips. You know, there's a kind of a little stickiness there. I feel like rye can have especially that much of it can get that the spice can get a little gnarly. But I think the sweetness on this one kind of covers that.
Right, balances it out.
Yeah, again with the balance,
a nice balance. Yeah.
Yeah. And is it just two row then? The rest of it is two row and then rye malt?
Yeah, it's different kinds of rye malt. So it has toasted rye, it has that red rye crystal rye malt. So there's layers of rye malt in there to make the flavor a bit more complex and boil for a long time as well to keep the sweetness a bit high to balance out the spiciness from the rye.
Okay.
But I guess to make it more of a fortified wine experience, hence the name rye wine. So that's why the sweetness also plays a role in there. And then we use some hefty amount of American hops to get some fruitiness to also balance it out a little bit.
All right. That was my next question, is if hop variety even matters on this or if you're looking for IBU, but you just said you're looking for some fruitiness. Yeah.
Yeah, we use a Chinook in that one. And Columbus, and we fermented with an English strain to get some of the esters to pair up with the spiciness from the rye.
Okay.
Now, do you do a fair amount of correction you know, post ferment. Let's say, you know, especially like the first time you've brewed a beer, you've got it in the tank. Do you find yourself, you mentioned making a correction on, I think, the session beer. Do you find yourself making corrections on some of these, you know, other beers with all these different flavors sometimes? What I always found myself doing was, you know, we made a beer called Goo, and it had, you know, toasted coconut and chocolate and vanilla and, you know, bourbon and bourbon barrel aged. And I felt like, okay, you know, vanilla's not coming through enough. We need to goose the vanilla a little bit. And, you know, we did a lot of in-tank adjustments to get it just right before we released it. Do you find yourself doing that? Because when you deal with all these flavors, it seems like you would need to, you know, either you're getting really lucky or you're making some adjustments.
Yeah.
No, we make a lot of adjustments. I would say like 50% are sure bets where we have some prior experience where we kind of nail things down on the first try. Mm. This one, the rye wine, was actually, we were pretty lucky, I guess, because it turned out great on the first try. But the brunch blunch we had, you guys were having earlier, that one was tweaked just before packaging with some sodium bicarbonate to bring up more of the chalkiness of the stout, because it was brewed as a IPA pretty much, because the rice was an IPA. But since we used some lactic acid and phosphoric acid throughout the process, it was not drinking as a stout. And then we did some trials, and the sodium bicarb just got that round flavor from the bicarbonate and sodium as well. And it just was then drinking like a stout. So right before beers are packaged, we sample them all and we sign them off for packaging. If they're not as we wanted them to be, we take a few more days to try and find the solution. Hmm. For each beer to make it, you know, as we want them to be.
Now, where did you learn all of your, where did you gain all of your knowledge about, you know, how to adjust beers and, you know, using sodium bicarbonate to make this adjustment or all the other things that you clearly have
that's coming,
you
know, in the book.
Knowledge and, yeah.
I'm like, if you didn't want to buy George's forthcoming book before that answer he just gave, you do now.
right. There you go.
So that's a great question, Jibo. How did you find this stuff out?
It was just trial and error, you know, like having a beer from the bright and saying, this is not right. We could do better. And then thinking, what could make the beer better? And then getting a bit of powder, putting it in a glass, swirling. Mm. This tastes better. And then you actually do a proper trial where you get a certain amount of beer, do a calculated amount of addition, try to calculate how much you need to add, and then add it to the beer and see how it turns out. But it's just tasting the beers. And I think being a brewer allows you to be in constant contact with the beer, and how the beer develops from the moment you brew the wort all the way. Mm-hmm.
But there is some backwards engineering there.
So the beer behaves and transforms. Yeah, a little bit, I guess.
Because with that specific example, you might have gone, okay, so what makes a stout, right? All right, that, like if it was just a stout, the water where they made stouts to begin with would have been high in this bicarbonate, right? So in some ways, you're taking your knowledge of beer styles, of classic beers, to remedy your modern beers.
Yeah, absolutely. You just know a few pointers and you use those pointers to try to guide you to a certain direction.
Yeah.
I mean, it's something we've done before. It's something we've tried before. So we have this encyclopedia of things we can do to beers when they're not as we want them to be. So, and the more we try on them, the easier it gets to adjust them.
I see.
Before being packaged.
Yeah. I guess my question is, how did you gain that encyclopedic knowledge of brewing?
Yeah.
Did you go to, you know, brewing school, or what did you study?
Well, I think it's just a generic interest on food and beverage, just cuisine, cooking, getting a lot with other than just brewers, getting along with the winemakers, distillers, getting a lot of perception from other school of thoughts, getting in with cooks and learning how the other people think about products in general and trying to apply that into beer. So it's not only beer knowledge, it's just food and beverage knowledge and trying to apply that to beer.
Yeah.
I did go to brewing school, or kind of still going, but it's just collecting bits of knowledge here and there and trying to make my own puzzle, I guess.
And I the answer I was looking for was, you listen to the Jamel show.
I know exactly what answer you were looking for. Yeah. But George is too smart to fall into that trap.
That's right. Hey, for what it's worth, I saw your book on the show.
I've listened to hours and hours of podcasts from you guys, so that comes without saying.
So. Right. And still, by the way, a great question. And I was not even trying to simplify it too much by saying, oh, know about where stout came from. Mm-hmm. I more was saying, yeah, once you sort of have this established encyclopedia of knowledge, to really sit down and think about it and apply it is just something that not all brewers do. But then again, not all brewers are brewing such complex beers, too.
Right.
So
he's in a great position, too, where they allow him to create.
Right.
Yeah. So he has a certain kind of beer style and certain flavors, and he knows what sells, and he knows what he can make, and he knows how to use these ingredients, and he's putting them together really, really well.
Yeah. Yeah. That was a great beer. All right. Well, I finished my glass of Tom.
I finished my glasses, all of these.
You have every single
he's
one.
He's not driving.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, and now we've just poured for ourselves, George, also in the 6 years series. This one is called Marguerite, I think it's pronounced.
Yeah.
And it's a freeze-distilled red velvet stout. Who's Marguerite?
Mother of the four brothers.
Okay, wonderful. Also with a picture on the can of her holding a birthday cake, which is pretty cool. And then this one is our, I guess, the biggest one we've had in the list so far, 16%.
That's an easy drinking 16.
I haven't tried it. Is it really? I mean, they all are, but
yeah.
So
you won't even notice it.
Is freeze distilled? Is that the same as like a ice bock, George?
Yeah, that's an ice bock.
Okay, it's the same. Okay, and then what makes it a red velvet stout in this case?
Well, red velvet is just a kind of a name because red velvet doesn't even have raspberries or sour cherries in it, but it's red and has chocolate, so that's the thing.
Okay.
This beer has a raspberry, sour cherry, and chocolate added to it.
Oh, wow.
That makes the red out of the velvet thing, really, I guess.
And the base of it was just a stout or an imperial stout?
Yeah, it was an imperial stout, brewed to 11% ABV.
Okay.
And then it was freeze distilled to roughly 17% ABV. And then we added fruit to it. At that point, there's no more yeast in there, no activity, no nothing. So we could add fruit with the residual sugar to it without the worry of re-fermenting at any point.
Okay.
So we just added the fruit before packaging to retain the juiciness from the fruit into the beer.
I see. Wow.
So much going on.
It's amazing. Now, okay, there's not no heat. Like I'm not saying I'd go, oh, 16%, but right. Going down.
There's some warmth.
And I like it. By the way, I want it there because
you like it going down.
It's got enough sweetness that it needs to be cut up a little bit. I feel like.
Uh-huh.
So it's not there. Go ahead, Jason.
That aroma of like fresh raspberry really, really comes through too.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. There's so much to talk about. It does taste. It's got some chocolate going on. The raspberry is fresh and bright. There's, I think, a lot of sweetness, but then the alcohol cuts through that.
And the raspberry.
Yeah.
The fruit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The acidity.
Tart
of the
cherries,
fruit.
You said, too.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We also used sour cherries to kind of balance that out. We added some white oak, some American oak, to make the tannins a bit more pronounced, to round up the edges with the alcohol and the sweetness to make it more balanced. And maybe a touch of vanilla went in there, too, just to get the cake profile building up.
Hmm. You put it in those oak barrels, or you added like oak chips or something?
Oak chips, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Which kind of speeds up the process too, doesn't it? To get some oak flavor in there.
Yeah, absolutely. And they're virgin, so the tannins are much more pronounced than an oak barrel.
Hmm.
So, and then you can control better because you can do it by taste. You can add it and make it be in contact with beer for the time you need it to be. Once the taste and flavor is dialed in, you just take it out and remove it from contact with beer.
Okay.
What is the time frame on something like this?
Yeah.
You mean the whole process?
Yeah.
Well, just bring a regular beer, then we send it out to a freeze house. Takes about 2 weeks to get it completely frozen. And then we receive it back at the brewery. It's huge, a huge mess. IBC containers laying around the brewery, you know, stacking onto each other. Octopus of hoses dragging on the floor. And then we start the distillation process. That's just letting the beer thaw slowly and moving into a bright tank.
Wow.
With a flow meter, so we know, and then we usually go by taste and ABV concentration. Because you can stop the process a bit too early, and then it's too alcoholic. So we try to dial in volume, ABV, and flavor, those three parameters. Once it's done, then we do the adjuncts of the fruit, chocolate, vanilla, and so on.
So in other words, the most difficult beer in the world. I didn't even think about having to send it somewhere to be frozen. I assumed you do that in the fermenter.
In your refrigerator?
Well, no, I just thought an industrial size glycol system could freeze. But that's not the case.
Can't get that cold.
What temperature do you have to get to?
You've got to get, you know, minus something C. You know, you got to get generally, when we freeze beer in the U.S., we need to get down to, you know, we'll put it in a minus 4, minus something
Wow.
Fahrenheit, you know.
Okay. That was way down there. Okay.
It's like a standard freezer.
I see.
We'll do it.
Yeah. Okay. But a glycol system on a conical fermenter can't do that.
Your glycol is generally running around 29 degrees Fahrenheit, 28 degrees Fahrenheit.
Okay.
Because you're using glycol, you're really not going to get it lower than that.
Okay.
You know, you can, but
yeah,
it's just not a realistic thing. And a beer, once you get to 6-7%, they won't freeze at all at those temperatures.
I see.
Or to any of, you know, even lower than that won't freeze.
Wow. So what are these containers you're shipping it off in? Like big plastic totes or what?
Yeah, just IBC. A plastic tote, like an IBC container.
Yeah,
with a metal cage.
With beer.
I know. Okay. Yeah. Oh, there those. Okay.
Yeah.
Got it. Okay. And then just so I understand, then you get it back, and in this slow thawing process, you have to carefully transfer it to another vessel at a flow rate that matches the thaw rate that you're looking for, so that you're not just transferring alcohol or not just transferring back what you sent away anyway. Am I understanding that?
Yeah. That's pretty much it.
Okay.
Yeah. It's a lot of work, but
yeah,
we do that twice a year, so okay, it's reasonable.
2 days of no sleeping. We should do our next show on one of those days of the year, because you're going to be awake anyway. So,
do you make money on this beer?
Good question.
We did.
I have no idea, man. I'm the brewer.
I love that answer.
See, that's why the two of you never should have started a brewer.
I know.
Terrible idea. At Heretic, we did freeze beer in a tank. We've got one little yeast propagation tank.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a 5-barrel tank, and it doesn't use glycol. It uses refrigerant.
Okay.
And so with refrigerant, we're able to freeze it in that tank.
I see.
So we're able to do that.
So you did one that way.
Yes.
Well, and at the break, you just taught me, Jamil, I find this astonishing, right, that Eisbach, essentially, the process is
illegal
in the U.S.
In the U.S., yeah.
I didn't know that.
Well, you can't freeze distill past like a 0.4% maximum. They generally allow the breweries to do it because of all the ice beers in the U.S.,
okay,
Miller Ice and, you know,
right,
whatever ice.
I thought that was just a but name. Ice. I didn't even think right. They were icing those beers.
What they do is they freeze it, and then they, I don't know, they water it back or whatever. But
okay,
they have to get approximately to the same. You can't concentrate stuff because that's considered distilling in the U.S.
Okay.
So you have to have a distillery license. So I submitted. I told a homebrewer I would brew their Eisbach because
because I'm Jamil.
Well, for the homebrew conference.
I do what I want.
Okay,
and
yeah.
So I applied to the TTB under our distillery license to freeze distill this thing. And they told me, no, can't do that. This is a beer. Submit it as a beer. I'm like, okay, but it's not allowed to concentrate it this much under the beer license. So
right.
I submitted as a beer, and they're like, you can't do this. So you freeze concentrate too much. I'm like, yes, I know.
I told you.
That's why I submitted it as a distillery item. And the beer person goes like, well, okay, activate that and I'll approve it. I'm like, okay. So I reactivated my distilling application for this beer. And
I see.
They approved it. So the problem is it's taxed as a spirit.
Okay.
So it's a much higher tax rate. But still, we got to legally produce an ice block in the U.S.
But of course, that goes back to Jason's question: how do you make money on a beer like that? Because you would have had to charge me.
No, you don't. Yeah. But okay. Who cares?
Right.
You know, that's not the reason you open a brewery. If you're opening a brewery to make money, you're an idiot. I'll tell you right now.
Yeah. Right. And then, so the other, just to point this out, and we've been talking about it casually the whole time, all of these styles are in cans for you guys. And here in the U.S., now you might find some the breweries putting these styles in cans, but in general,
they're
still doing bottles. Yeah. But do you guys do any bottle products? Is it everything cans for you?
Yeah, it's minimal amount. We have this membership club where we do some bottles,
yeah.
And that's about it. Everything else is cans. It's just easier to have a streamlined
yeah.
format for us to make production to be a bit more leaner and just be able to make volume.
Okay.
And just eases out the process a lot.
Okay. And then, so that means everything is carbonated in the tanks before you guys can too, yeah. right? There's no sort of can yeah. conditioning. You can't do that. Okay.
No can conditioning. Everything is carbonated when it goes to cans.
Yeah. Well then, which also I think helps you dial it in, because that was another thing I noticed. Each and every one of these, like, carbonation right where it should be, right to the style, or at least, I don't know, they're not even styles, right to where they taste great with what you've produced, including this one. Just like a little bit of carbonic bite there.
Mm. Yeah, we got pretty good equipment to measure carbonation and all that, so we have our process pretty well dialed in. It comes the engineering set of ice. They
yeah.
really want to have the numbers dialed in, the equipment. They don't look at the expense. If that's the equipment we need, that's the equipment we get to get the results they want. So
yeah,
can't complain about that.
Love it.
I wish I could afford an Anton Park.
Yeah, well, you know, should have found brothers that are engineers. I don't know what to tell you, Jason. Well, George, I know it's getting awful late there, and we've gotten through, well, at least what we can handle getting through today,
right.
I think. Thank you so much for being on the show and really for sending that beer with these guys, because it's all just fantastic.
No, it was a pleasure being here, and next time they'll take even more beer.
Need a bigger suitcase.
Carry it.
Yeah. Yeah, now that we know about you, I'll be requesting more the next time, everything. George Chume from More Schleudel. You can go to moreschleudel.com. Figure out how to spell it. You'll find it on Google there. And they are in the Netherlands. And you can look at all of the beers that we talked about. I found them on the website, so you can read more about them. You can meet the team on the website, the families there. It's actually a really well-done web presence that you guys have, too, so people can learn plenty about you. And man, I wish you luck. Are you now a Netherlands resident? Is this your home for the foreseeable yeah. future? Yeah.
Yeah, that's where I live now. So
I like it.
You can find me around in Alkmaar in the Netherlands. So if you're ever around, just let me know.
Good for you. I'm ready to move, Jamil.
I am too.
Right?
Let's go.
Especially if you live, not just in the U.S., but just particularly California. Everybody's ready to go if you're from California. All right, George, thank you again for being with us. Jamil and Jason, thanks for lugging the beer all across yeah. Europe and then
you're
across
welcome.
The pond, man. Yeah, sorry, Jason, thank you for...
We should have just drank it ourselves.
There was a couple days we got pretty close.
Yes.
Where you're short on beer that day and just needed... You could have opened a couple. I mean, come on. No one would.
You start opening one, you know what happens.
Yeah,
Soon you have an empty
slippery
box.
Slippery slope.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us here today on The Session. You can find more sessions all the time. Subscribe on iTunes and every other place you'd like to do it. Thanks to our sponsor, More Beer. Thanks to our sponsor, the 21st Amendment Brewery. They've always been with us since the beginning, and we appreciate that. You can hit the donate button on our homepage, and that helps us out. You can do your Amazon shopping by clicking the Amazon link. and that helps us out. And just support all of our sponsors, Williams Brewing, people that have been with us all these years, really keeping the Brewing Network alive, and we appreciate it. Thanks again to Jay-Z for always being around and doing great content for us, and Jason for hanging out today. And we'll see you next time right here on The Session. Session is a production of the Brewing Network and brought to you by More Beer. Check them out at morebeer.com. Find more content and live video of this show on our YouTube channel at youtube.com/brewingnetwork. For sponsorship opportunities and information, please reach out to advertising@thebrewingnetwork.com. To reach our hosts, contact feedback@thebrewingnetwork.com.